Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey guys, welcome back to Soul Sisters. Jessie Katz here with
Dara Gollum.
Dara Gollum. Hi, Dara Gollum.
Hi, Jessie.
How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm good. I have to tell you something I think you would appreciate,
ooh,
which is that we had a special performance in our office today,
ooh,
by Alan Menken.
Composer?
Yes.
Wow.
Of like, Little Mermaid,
yeah.
Beauty and the Beast,
whoa.
Aladdin,
whoa,
which is now on Broadway, and he was doing Aladdin songs,
wow,
as part of our Tony series.
Fun.
Yeah. So he played some Aladdin songs, which was part of his thing. And then he did a funny little thing at the end where he was like, any requests? And then he just started playing Under the Sea.
Oh,
and
man.
I legit started crying.
Did you really?
Yeah.
Little That's Mermaid. A funny song to cry at.
I know. It's just, I mean, if it had been part of your world, I would have actually evaporated. It would have been too much.
Does he have a beautiful voice? I don't know.
He has a very lovely voice, mm-hmm, but it's like, those are his songs.
Yeah.
Those are the songs of my life. It was,
whoa,
so
wait, did you say
intense.
Beauty and the Beast?
Yes. Which
is coming to
out
theaters
this Friday.
Ooh.
Do you have plans
what
to
see
it?
What do you think it? About it? Definitely not.
Okay.
I definitely don't have plans to see
but
it.
But you will see it?
I don't really think I will.
Why?
But I don't know.
Are you afraid?
I'm not a Beauty and the Beast fan. I'm not a huge...
Whoa. Jesus, my head just spun around like The Exorcist.
I did see Aladdin on Broadway. I'm not a Disney fan. The music is amazing, but I'm not like a Disney head.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Like you weren't, mm-hmm, as a child?
Not really. I've seen most of them.
This musical has a Disney,
yeah, it's
block.
It's a little bit of like a gulf there. I don't know.
Wow. Secrets revealed on, yeah, Soul Sisters today. This is fascinating.
Like I've never seen, I feel like there's ones that I've never seen. Like I've never seen 101 Dalmatians.
Whatever.
Okay,
here's about,
okay,
that. But if I got Angela Lansbury in this room and she's saying Beauty and the Beast to you, you would cry.
I would definitely
like
cry.
There were 1,000 brandies sitting in front of you.
Never gonna live that down. And I'm okay with that.
That's a Soul Sisters callback.
It's totally great. I'm proud of that moment.
You should be. Emotions are healthy.
Emotions are great. No, I mean, the music of Beauty and the Beast, certainly. The,
yeah,
movie, I don't have like a connection to.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yes.
I don't know.
Yeah. Okay. That's,
yeah,
fair.
Aladdin, the film, I have a connection to. Little Mermaid, a little bit. Like Lion King, no.
Yeah.
You know?
Right, right.
What are,
right,
the other big ones?
Someone
that
in my
love?
Office said, well, Alan Menken didn't do the music for Lion King. And I was like, fuck Lion King. And he was like, but Elton John. And I was like, fuck Elton John. He's no,
wait,
Alan Menken.
Wait, why
like,
fuck
got
Lion
really
King?
Contentious.
Why?
Because this is really getting into the weeds about my Disney experience growing up, but I was just old enough when Lion King came out where like I wasn't trying to like pretend like I was in the Lion King anymore. I was just like, I'm gonna see a Disney movie, this is nice. But it's not like
I'm not
when
as
I was
obsessing.
Six and saw Little Mermaid and
right.
I was Ariel forever.
Six?
I think I was six. I think it was 88.
Yeah, I guess. Okay. Jungle
anyway.
Book. Never saw the cartoon.
Oh,
the
Jungle
Disney
Book's
version.
Very good.
People love that.
Yeah, very good.
Yeah,
okay.
And like the music. Like, I don't know the music.
Really?
Yeah.
Louis
I mean,
Prima.
I do now because...
Okay.
Yeah,
anyway.
Anyway, that's a fun day.
Yeah, it was a great day.
That's a happy day.
Uh-huh.
A little happy tears.
Yeah. So, also a happy day because we had,
woo,
Suzanne Vega,
oh my
on the
God,
podcast.
That was so damn cool. I can't
speaking
even.
Of songs from your childhood that you feel like you've known forever.
Yeah. Well, our entire life—it wasn't even like a childhood. I feel like it's like it keeps coming back in adulthood,
right, and
almost.
Remains,
yeah,
and remains.
Tom Steiner,
the do 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 do. That song.
She sang it a cappella for us.
Yes. So stay tuned to the end.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, it's great. She's lovely.
She's so lovely. Singing that a cappella, I mean, she's done that in so many different ways, and to sing that a cappella, it's—I don't know—something so bold and beautiful about it.
Yeah. She's badass.
Ooh.
She was a good soul sister.
Yeah.
All right. So here you go, guys. Suzanne Vega.
How are you?
Good, thanks.
And where are you coming from today?
I'm coming from rehearsal.
For the Carlisle,
awesome. Yes, which opens tomorrow in the middle of this blizzard we're supposed to be getting.
Yeah.
I'm glad that we snagged you before the blizzard, but yeah. Fingers crossed for tomorrow night.
Yeah. What are they saying about, are they like on alert? Or is it just on?
Fingers crossed.
It's just on.
It's on.
Yeah,
okay.
It's just like the show must go
doing
on.
It. Okay, great.
But you know what? We've gone to a bunch of shows there, and I feel like so many people in the audience are either staying in the hotel or they're
nearby,
staying around.
Right.
Or yeah. I'm sure you'll still have a great turnout.
It's one of our favorite places to be.
Yeah. And what's a better thing to do on a blizzardy evening than
heaven.
To go see your show?
Ooh.
I think that's actually great timing, maybe.
So we're talking about Lover Beloved.
Yeah.
Songs from an Evening with Carson McCullers.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a good place to start, actually.
Sure.
So can we, well, okay. But what part of this story do we start at? Because you've had a relationship with this author for decades at this point, right?
Yes, for a long time.
You go way back.
Way back. Yeah. So Carson McCullers, Southern Gothic author.
Yes.
Is it true that you started reading her when you were...
I was a teenager.
Okay.
Yeah, I was 15.
And fell in love.
Yeah, I fell in love with her writing then. There was a short story called Sucker, which I really enjoyed. It didn't occur to me to look anything else up, but it stuck with me. At the time, I had assumed it was written by a man. I thought Carson McCullers must be a man.
Mm-hmm.
And the lead character of that story is male. So I didn't really think about it again until I suddenly saw her biography, which came out in the late 70s. And when I saw the cover, I thought, oh, that's Carson McCullers. And I was very surprised to see that she was female.
Isn't it wonderful, though, the things that you don't know when you aren't able to check the internet?
Mm-hmm, I was just thinking.
It's kind of a magic thing that we've lost, you know, in a certain
way. It was a world. Things were revealed much more slowly back then.
Right,
so
exactly.
It really was kind of a magical thing to see her face for the first time on the cover of this book. And so that made an impression.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't really kind of get to start digging around in her character until I was at college. And I was taking an acting class. And we were given an assignment by my teacher to come in the next day dressed as someone in the arts who was no longer alive and be ready to answer questions as though you were on television.
Mm-hmm.
So I bought that biography and I read the whole thing. It was a big fat book like this, like a phone book, and read it, found a costume and came in dressed and ready to answer questions. And it became very... her world that she inhabited kind of took over for a little while back then, and that became my thesis in school.
Nice. And that's another thing that I think was probably beautifully enhanced by the fact that you couldn't find videos of her. Not to sound like a weird millennial, like I don't usually do this, where I'm like, but the internet. But that's also awesome that you had to...
invent it totally.
Yeah, just like take from her text what you imagined
her
interior
and her photographs.
World was.
Well, her photographs mostly, because I had been trained as a dancer through my teens. So she has very distinctive body language, very, very tall and very thin and smoking constantly in all of her photographs. Very angular, kind of peculiar way of looking.
Uh-huh.
And so I imagined what it was like to be hugely tall and then to be stooped over. And to be very shy.
Yeah.
And then to use her hands the way she seemed to use her hands.
Uh-huh. I want to pick your brain about something that I was thinking about recently. And when I was reading about you and your relationship with her, it seemed really relevant to me. This idea of writing from a voice of someone who is other than you.
Mm-hmm.
And that it's a very complicated matter.
Mm-hmm.
Like a very simple example of this that is controversial is, say, when you have... like a room full of men who are writing characters for TV that are female.
Right. This has been an issue in the news lately. Yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah.
But it's interesting then to think about a woman author who is writing in the voice of a man, and there's something beautiful and complex and illuminating about that. But you know, it can really cut either way. And mm-hmm. as a songwriter, you certainly do that as well.
I've done that many times. Yeah.
So it's like to a certain extent, as an artist, that's the whole point, right? Is empathizing with the human condition, which is not necessarily defined by your gender or your mm-hmm. color. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, like, you don't want to say that your experience living in that skin or that gender isn't important.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. You're saying the risk of it coming off in a certain way that.
Yeah, like appropriate. Right, I don't know. Right. It's so complicated.
It is complicated. I mean, her first novel, which she started, I guess, when she was 19, uh-huh. she has five characters. One is a deaf mute. One is a young girl, a young white girl in the South. One of her most distinctive characters, I think, is the black doctor. He's kind of a middle class black man who's very angry and very articulate. And I think she did a great job with that character. I think he's really believable. You see him and feel him, and he's very clear in his feelings and his beliefs, which was one of the reasons I think that book was such a success.
Yeah.
But I do wonder whether nowadays she would be criticized for daring to assume that she knew.
But
I think it was based on someone that she knew in her town, and she just kind of was able to kind of get into his voice and into his mind and have him express himself on the page.
Sure. I mean, I think the criticism is probably valid, but I also think the art is also valid.
I think how it's done. It really is how it's done. You can, and she was criticized later on in life for being anti-Semitic. Mm-hmm. Which she was not at all. I mean, that was not her intention at all.
Right,
but in some
ways,
she reflected the times that she lived in.
Yeah.
So, you know, some of the things, I think, if we look back on her work now, there might be some jarring moments, even though I think she was so far ahead of her time, of her own time.
Mm-hmm. Well, the last line of Carson's Last Supper is, "The love of my life is humanity," which I think is
I believe that was true for her.
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of the key ingredient, I think, to being able to do that, to put yourself in someone else's shoes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Is just tapping into the humanity.
Yeah.
That it should be universal at a certain level.
Yeah, that was her credo was really universal love and agape love. And she talked about that in her writings. And it comes out a lot in the play that I've written, which is actually going to have its world premiere on Valentine's Day of 2018.
Oh, really?
Wow, where?
At the Alley Theater in Houston, Texas.
Oh, amazing. Exciting.
I'm very excited.
That's great.
Yes.
So you basically put monologues with the music that's even on the record.
Yes. I have a backlog of songs that I've been writing on and off since way back then.
Okay.
So there'll probably be about 16 songs in the play. And it's meant to be a play. It's not just monologues, but sort of the arc of her life. The first act takes place in 1941, where her first book was just published to great acclaim. Her second book has just come out to terrible reviews. Hmm. So she's giving a speech at something similar to the 92nd Street Y in New York, and she's trying to explain what's gone on in her life since her huge success and then this terrible reviews for her second book. The second act takes place in 1967 at the same venue.
Okay.
And this is a month or two before she dies. So you get the whole arc of her whole life. And then these songs are in there to illuminate what's going on in the moment.
Wow. Well, I thought this was an interesting place to start with you because it feels so similar. It feels almost like a meta kind of place of your journey almost. And I wonder how long.
It's kind of interesting.
I
hadn't thought of it, but you're kind of right.
I don't know. I mean, you know, you're
described. I started this before I had my first record deal, so.
Right. And how long, like in the process when you were creating this role and exploring her in theater, where were you in your songwriting and poetry writing? How much was her, you know, sensibility influencing your writing at that early age?
It would be pretty unconscious. I mean, I read a lot. It's not like I was only reading Carson McCullers. I read and read and read and read.
Right.
And I sort of go wherever my imagination takes me. But I do believe her, what would you call it? Not her credo or her ideology, you know, that's something. The reason I think she writes so truthfully is because I also believe in universal love in my writing and my songwriting.
Right.
You know, which not everybody does. Some people, it's all about the erotic, or, you know, obviously when you turn on the radio, 98% of what you hear is about sex, and, you know, and that's fine too, but that's not particular, you know, I'm not always going to write about that.
Uh-huh.
Or if I do, I write about it in my own unique way.
Right. There's a lot of ways to describe the artist that you are. And one of the, you know, you're a singer, a songwriter, a storyteller, a laid back troubadour, I've heard.
And then, Not so laid back for those who know me.
and a phrase, the town crier for alienated souls the world over.
Hmm.
Now that's about Carson.
Yeah.
But I feel like that's similar to you as well. So there's this nice mixture.
It's a mixture, yeah. I mean, I love her work, and I think she's definitely had her influences over the years. Yeah, to be sure.
Can we talk about April 1st being the 30th anniversary of Solitude
Oh,
Standing?
Yeah, sure.
How do you feel about that milestone?
I feel fine. I feel good. I mean,
is it big record?
What the
breakout,
hell happened?
The break, was it? Is it the breakout, or is it? I mean, it's number two. Your second record.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Was this considered the breakout? Yes.
It was, yeah.
Well, the first one was very well received, right?
It was well received, but more than that, it sold a million copies all around the world.
Right, that is
it sold 17,000 copies the first week it was released.
Screw the critics.
I was amazed.
Your debut album?
My debut album.
Oh, okay.
Which I remembered because I knew that A&M Records had thought they were going to sell 30,000. So they told me, it sold 17,000 the first week. And I thought, oh, great, we're halfway there, you know. And it's only been out a week.
What a difference.
So,
wow.
Yeah.
What do you credit that to?
Yeah. I had been working my
rear
end off.
Yeah, say it, I work.
for years. So by the time it came out, I think there had been a buzz. I had done some touring. Mm-hmm. I had done a lot of work at, like, Folk City, learning how to perform. Mm-hmm. And so there were people talking about it. So that's, you never actually know. I mean, it's people in marketing and stuff pretend that they know, but you don't really know.
They want to justify the reason they have jobs.
Yes, you just want to. It's just something that kind of happens in the moment.
Did you know with Luca?
No, I had no idea.
No,
I wrote it, and interestingly enough, when I wrote it, it was not a popular song when I sang it myself on the guitar. It was something that some people couldn't figure out what it was about. And when they did find out what it was about, it made a lot of people uncomfortable.
Sure.
It was not something I got requests for, like Gypsy. Gypsy is a nice song with a chorus. You know, it's a love song, and most people wanted to hear that.
Uh-huh.
So when my manager said to me, I think that song could be a hit, I really thought he was being a little crazy. And we talked about what he said, is this about child abuse? And I said, it is. And he said, I really think that song could be a hit, and we need more songs about social issues.
Mm.
Because songs in the 80s are about nothing. And, you know, so we had this big discussion about it. And I said, okay, you have my permission to do whatever you want on the production, as long as we don't change the words. And to my surprise, I mean, they worked for 2 years on the production. So people who say it was a fluke, it's not exactly true, because they worked so hard to make it radio friendly.
Wow.
2 years.
Wow.
Arranging it and making sure the guitar solo was right and making sure the vocal really cut and making sure this and that. And
how involved were you in that process?
I was involved. You know, I would listen to it and approve everything.
Okay.
And
how did you feel about that final version?
I felt fine.
Okay. It didn't feel like a compromise? Like,
not at all.
It commercial?
No, it didn't. Okay. I was like, good luck.
Yeah.
You know,
right?
That's how I felt. I was like, go for it.
Yeah.
You know?
That's something so fantastic and refreshing that I find about you in general, is that seems to be your attitude about your music. You're like, I write this music, but it can sound so many different ways, and those ways can all be valid. I don't know your stance on that exactly, because it's such a topic that most people feel very differently that, you know, this is how I hear it. This is how it should be. Yeah. And, you know, you change it, you appropriate it, you sample it, whatever.
Well, I'm a songwriter, so I write the songs, and what I write tends to be very simple. There was a musician who said to me once that people made too big a deal out of it. This was before I even had a record deal at all. And he said, why make a big fuss over it? You can always hear it in its original form. Mm. So why not try it this way? Why not try it that way? So that's kind of my rule of thumb. So
when was that?
Oh, that was like that 1982, 83.
Because it's so become our world that I think to step back and say, wow, that's such a wonderful thing that we have. Because it gets, you know, it gets lost and mixed up. And
a song like Tom's Diner can be remixed. It can be interpolated a million ways.
I mean, can I read off a few?
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
People who have used that song because it's such
out
a
of the
funny
what,
70
list. Plus? I don't know.
Yeah,
oh, it's more than 100. It's more than 100 by now, yeah.
Tupac, did you know?
Yes.
Great. Drake, Destiny's Child, and then Fall Out Boy and Britney recently.
To name the top like stars of all. Yeah.
And that it sounds perfect with all of them. It's great. Do you see yourself as a songwriter more than a musician per se? Like, is that why you say
I'm a songwriter. Yeah. I am an untrained musician.
Okay.
I had tried to get training, I'd say 7 or 8 times in my life.
I
play guitar, but I was never really trained. Not really. I usually end up having to hire someone to hire musicians, mm-hmm. you know, to someone who takes what I do and then they notate it and they give it to other people.
Uh-huh.
I actually have musicians in my family, which I didn't learn until I was in my late 20s.
Oh.
So then I found out that my father plays piano and that his mother was a drummer and his father was a trumpet player. So mm-hmm. I was amazed to find out that I actually had all this music in my family and none of them read music.
Right.
I consider myself a songwriter.
Uh-huh.
And
do you write for other artists?
No, but I write in other voices.
Yeah. Right.
And sometimes other people cover the songs.
Right.
Poet, troubadour. Yeah. And I mean, that's, I had wondered if this McCullers show was the first foray into acting, but it sounds like that's part of your background as well. Like you've always put on different
theater.
Hats.
I minored in theater in college and majored in English literature, minored in theater. And danced at LaGuardia High School. That was my major there, was modern dance. Wow. So I've always been doing something or another, and I wasn't sure which thing I would come through in.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And the songwriting thing kind of happened early.
It was the one that took first.
Yes.
So that was the winner.
That was the winner.
Yeah. So what did you say? What's the anniversary we're coming on to? With
the 30th.
30th.
The 30th.
Wow. So Tom's
April
Diner.
April 1st. Right?
That's,
yep. So no, I'm happy about it. For me, time does not mean anything. You know, I feel very much the same way as I did back then. I don't sit around going, oh, the time is passing. You know, to me, I don't really care. And I think of it as a reason to celebrate. And we'll probably do some shows later this year celebrating 30th anniversary of Solitude Standing and the 25th anniversary of...
That's
99.9 Fahrenheit
degrees. Wow. That's very cool. No, it should undoubtedly be a reason to celebrate. It's just funny sometimes you can look back at that much at any kind of big anniversary and feel either like that went by so fast or be like, yeah, I did a lot in between those years, yeah. You know?
I did a lot.
Yeah.
And that's between those years. Yeah.
Talk about a
that's
life
how I
of
feel.
A song.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
That song will have a life forever. And in fact,
which
I mean,
one?
Tom Steiner. Sorry. I mean, I'm curious how you, as such a storyteller and a songwriter storyteller, feel about the cultural impact that will be your legacy on top of the music. You know, I mean, Tom's Diner led to you being, quote unquote, the mother of the MP3, which
yes,
is a crazy thing, which means
kind of like,
basically,
oh.
Tom's Diner, the a cappella version was so warm and rich and able to analyze the, I'm not going to be able to explain the mechanics of it, but somehow it was the perfect music to create the format of what
yeah.
became
it's
the
like
MP3.
It was the prototype.
Yes, it was the prototype
they,
for
they
the MP3.
They decided that they had created what they called the MP3, and they heard my voice, and they said, oh, if this really works, we'll be able to run this song through the MP3, and it will recreate it perfectly. And if it doesn't recreate it perfectly, it will show up any flaws. And it was really flawed. I went to the Fraunhofer
wow.
Institute and heard
wow.
what it sounded like that first time they ran it through.
What
and it
was
like
this?
A monster.
Wow.
It sounded like The Exorcist. The year that they were doing this was the late 80s.
Okay.
So it was right after the album came out.
I wonder what they told you. Like, we're creating a digital.
They didn't tell me anything.
Yeah, like, what did
I read about
say
it on
that
the
they
internet.
Were trying to do?
No, I read about it on the internet.
Oh, you
internet.
Didn't know at the time what you were listening to? The prototype of a digital file.
Here's how it happened.
Yeah.
In the late 1980s, Karl-Heinz Brandenburg was one of the creators of the MP3, and he's the one who heard the song down the hallway and said, oh, let's see if this MP3 really works. They ran it through it, and it didn't work. So they ran it through for months until it finally came out clean and clear. But no one told me this. And they also used other songs and other people's voices and stuff like that.
Uh-huh.
In the year 2000, I think it was, I was dropping my daughter off at nursery school. And a random parent came over to me and said, congratulations on being the mother of the MP3. Now, I knew what an MP3 was because mm-hmm. I knew they had created something that could possibly kill the music industry. Everyone was talking about
right.
it at that time.
This was Napster era, I think.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So that sort of hit 1999, mm-hmm. something around there. So I really didn't know what this man was talking about. And he said, it's called, I think, Business Week 2.0. He says, go home and look it up on the internet and you'll see
That's
it. And
crazy.
I looked it up and I'm like, oh, look at that. I had no idea.
That's how you found out.
And that's how I found out.
Wow.
That's
yeah.
fascinating.
So it wasn't like they asked my permission, but
right.
they just mentioned it in an article. And then the closing sentence of that article was, so every MP3 that we hear, whether it's, I don't know, David Bowie or whoever, is a product of Karl-Heinz Brandenburg's ears and Suzanne Vega's voice, making her the mother of the MP3.
So
term was coined.
If you have any qualms about music streaming, you have only yourself to blame.
I know. I have such mixed feelings
Do
about
you?
It all. Well, you know, on the one hand, I'm pleased to be part of music history, and I'm kind of flattered that they used my voice.
Yeah.
And so that part of it has been kind of a kick, and it was interesting. You know, it's a very modern thing to be part of. But on the other hand, the music industry has really gone downhill since then.
Right.
So I've been part of that big arc, you know, in the 80s, everything was so overblown in a sense.
Right.
And we've just gone really downhill from there. So some people, I think, embrace the destruction of that music industry. Now music is free.
Right.
You can stream it. Some people love that, you know.
Yeah. Well, it was going
to
happen with or
without
you.
Just have to adapt
so.
Yes, exactly. So,
but
yeah. You do have to adapt. How do you feel like you've adapted?
Well, I don't get the royalties I once did, but then no, I don't think anybody does
right.
unless you're Adele.
Yeah.
And I have, you know, I love Adele, so, you know. But I've adapted by playing live.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah,
that's
right.
what I do.
Yeah,
and that's
that
how
lot.
I started, and I would play live, and that's how I get to make my cash flow.
Yeah.
I'm fine with that. I love performing live.
I'm curious how the royalties, not to get too specific about it, but how the royalties do work for just that dun, dun, dun. Like, how many notes, you know, entail?
It's
like,
legal. There are legal
like
limits.
A number of seconds.
There's,
right?
There's, I think it's a number of seconds. I can't remember if it's seven or nine,
right,
or
okay.
whatever, or if it's like,
because it's
there's
so
a whole
recognizable.
Phrase. It is recognizable.
Oh,
the
God,
one, the
like
one time that really
that
drove
moment.
Me crazy was when the Black Eyed Peas used enough to be recognizable, but they didn't use the second half of the phrase, so they didn't have to pay me for it.
Oh.
And I remember thinking, that's really not fair.
Yeah, they milked the system.
Yeah. They knew the system.
Right.
So
right.
they got the da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and then they went da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and so they
that's
didn't use the
enough?
Second half of the phrase. I don't think
oh,
it is enough.
Wow. I would have thought like even dun 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 da.
Well,
yeah, like
a lot of the journalists were like, oh, it's the Tom's Diner riff, and but...
yeah.
Oh, well,
yeah. So tricky. Well,
next yeah. time, if I ever right. see Will I Am, I'll be
yeah,
like,
tell him.
But you
like,
got
I
into
I think you owe me
yeah.
a little bit.
Take me out to dinner.
Yeah. yeah. Buy me a drink.
Yeah.
You dabbled a little bit with sampling yourself on
the last album.
The last album.
Yeah.
How did that go?
Talk about meta.
It went yeah. fine. It was so funny. Jerry Leonard was the producer of the last album, and he's also my guitar player, and we spent quite a bit of time on the road. Now, Jerry was the musical director for David Bowie, and we sort of have different musical tastes. So he's really into Arcade Fire and a lot of rock and roll.
Uh-huh.
And I really like hip hop, and there's like a lot of, so we would switch sometimes. I would make him listen to different things, and I was playing him 50 Cent.
You really like
Candy
hip-hop.
Shop. Yeah, I was like playing him 50 Cent Candy Shop, and I'm like, oh, you know, it should really be kind of like this, and he's listening. And finally he goes, why don't we just sample it? And I thought, oh, that's brilliant. You know, it never would have occurred to me.
Yeah.
I don't listen to music to see what
else.
I can steal. I've never done that. I've never like listened to music going, oh, let's steal this riff, let's
yeah.
steal that thing.
Mm-hmm.
And when he said it, I thought this would be perfect. So we approached him, and he said he was a fan, and he gave us a great price for
awesome.
It. Yeah, so it was very, very affordable, and it wasn't
cool.
quite 50 cents, but it was, it was good.
The name of that song is Don't Uncork What You Can't Contain.
Yeah.
And I don't know, I'm just reading a lot into that. In
okay.
terms of
do tell.
Yeah, do tell.
Give us your interpretation. And
I'm
then...
kind of making all of these connections as far as what got uncorked with Tom's Diner and the chain of things that have come from it. And so I wonder if that was like a reference to, you know, opening
that's
some opening any genie bottle.
Yeah,
it's
and a reference to opening any genie bottle.
It wasn't a direct nod in any way to like sampling, and you know, because you.
Well, it wasn't intended to be, but I mean, it, you know, sometimes that happens. You write a song and it has more resonances than
right.
you expected.
Yeah. Can I rephrase the question?
Sure.
What would you say was your biggest uncorking in your artistically for you in your lifetime? Was there like a moment or a period of your life where like it really like clicked and opened up?
I think it was Luca.
Yeah.
That surprised me. The resonance that song had around the world
uh-huh.
and the letters that I got from people talking about their own situations and the spotlight that it thrust me into
mm-hmm.
and the number of sales of record CDs at that point, all of it kind of threw me kind of up into a really high profile.
Yeah.
Did at
you
that
feel
moment
prepared
in time.
For it? Or
no,
did
no,
that have
not
a
really.
Dark side for you to be thrown into that?
Well,
spotlight?
it was hard to celebrate that. On the one hand, we were celebrating the success, but on the other hand, I felt a lot of responsibility towards the people who wrote to me. And people wrote to me in a way expecting me. It was as though I had a magic power. You know,
mm-hmm.
sometimes they would expect me to be able to fix the problem
mm-hmm.
for them. And I took it very seriously. I wrote to every person who wrote to me that year. I wrote to them by hand. And if I had to give advice, I sometimes would give advice. Most of the time, like get professional help or don't stay in that situation or, you know. So that made it hard to feel as though...
it was a celebration.
A celebration,
yeah.
So that was really...
Is that
it was a lot to deal with, and I still get letters. You know, it's a much smaller world for me these days, but I still
it's had a tail.
Get letters. Yeah,
Well, I was just going to say, does that still happen, but maybe in a digital form, or things are just coming at you all the time? And I mean,
No, it's not all the time. It's on Facebook, or especially Facebook, which I spend a lot of time on Facebook, and I respond a lot. If someone approaches me sincerely, I will respond to them.
Do you get tweets about it, and then you have to craft a very careful, loving tweet back to somebody?
Or I'll, usually it's private. You know, people don't always want to put that stuff
DM.
Out there.
Yeah.
So I... So I respond to it, and but that was sort of, I would say, the biggest kind of like, wow. So, you know, being associated with something as painful as child abuse has been a continuing, I don't want to say an issue, but it's been part of my life, part of my career.
Yeah, it's a very tangible example of the way that you can touch somebody with your art when you put out a piece like that.
Because
art in general can make people feel less lonely.
Yeah.
But that's very specific.
Yeah, the stories that I received were amazing. I mean, one girl wrote to me to say that because of the song, she shared it with her doctor, and therefore she was moved out of her home. She feels the song saved her life because her father was so abusive that she was in the hospital.
Right.
So that... I mean, these are stories that are very...
Yeah, that's real. That's important work.
Yeah.
And again, it's something that sort of came more from your imagination almost. You saw a kid and made a story, mostly, right?
Mostly.
Yeah. I mean, and that's what you do, who find characters and...
Yeah, it's a mixture of things, you know, of... there was a boy named Luca. He lived in my building. He was not an abused child. I've known other people who were... And so I put it together to make this thing.
Yeah. I saw someone online went down a rabbit hole trying to figure out which actor passed away in Tom's Diner.
Did you figure it out?
There's so many rabbit holes for that. It's crazy.
Have you spoken about this? Because I didn't actually search further.
Well, there's Tom's Diner Day.
Okay.
Oh, my gosh.
Which is November 18th because a group of people did figure out which actor and figured out which day he died and which day it was.
Was it William Holden?
Yes.
Okay.
It's so crazy that
they
people
were like,
thought,
and I think
took
it's William
it literally
Holden.
And tried to, you wrote it.
And now everybody makes fun of me because they were like, you didn't know who William Holden was? And I'm like, sorry.
Also, that's my song.
Cannot win. That's so funny. Oh, man.
Oh, well. I do now.
You can't know them all.
Yep.
Let's talk about the Carlisle.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's your first time playing there, right?
It is my first time playing there.
Yes.
I've seen shows there before,
right.
I'm really, really psyched.
You've never been up on that tiny stage.
Up on that tiny stage, and I'll be sharing it with other musicians, so we'll all be like...
Mm-hmm. So it's very intimate.
Yes.
Yeah. So you're playing songs from the last album and some other...
We're playing the songs that people probably know
okay.
from a lot of different points in my career.
Oh, great.
From the first album, you know, songs like Left of Center, of course, Luca and Tom's Diner. But we're playing a batch of the new songs from Lover Beloved.
Great.
With an eye towards telling everybody about the play next year.
That's exciting.
I'm hoping to have a run in New York after the opening in Houston, Texas. I'm hoping that second stop will be New York City.
Wow. Perfect.
Yeah.
Okay, so you're at the Cafe Carlisle through March 25th.
Yeah.
And hopefully we'll only have one blizzard between then.
Yes.
Yes. Fingers crossed. Okay. Suzanne Vega, thank you so much.
Thank you. Amazing. This was really
fun. And you're going to perform something for us today, right?
Oh, yes. Why don't I do Tom's Diner? Because it's it's still good, I think.
It.
Okay.
It's still great. Still class. And you're doing it a cappella, is that correct?
I'm doing it a cappella today. There's no remix.
Yeah.
No remix equipment
No
on
guitar.
Me. No
front
guitar.
Row seat.
I never did it on guitar anyway. And so anyway.
Yeah.
When I do it live very often I will do it remixed, but this time you're getting it as it was actually written.
Amazing. Straight up. All right, cool. Thank you.
I am sitting in the morning at the diner on the corner. I am waiting at the counter for the man to pour the coffee. And he fills it only halfway. And before I even argue, he is looking out the window at somebody coming in. It is always nice to see you, says the man behind the counter to the woman who has come in. She is shaking her umbrella, and I look the other way as they are kissing their hellos, and I'm pretending not to see them, and instead I pour the milk. I open up the paper, there's a story of an actor who had died while he was drinking. It was no one I had heard of, and I'm turning to the horoscope and looking for the funnies when I'm feeling someone watching me, and so I raise my head. There's a woman on the outside looking inside. Does she see me? No, she does not really see me, 'cause she sees her own reflection, and I'm trying not to notice that she's stitching up her skirt, and while she's straightening her stockings, her hair has gotten wet. Oh, this rain, it will continue through the morning as I'm listening to the bells of the cathedral. I am thinking of your voice and of the midnight picnic once upon a time before the rain began. And I finish up my coffee and it's time to catch the train.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.